Michael Hightower, thank you for coming into KGOU and talking about your book, Banking in Oklahoma Before Statehood. When I first got the book, I'll have to admit that I instantly saw Banking in Oklahoma and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And then when I saw the Before Statehood, my first thought, well, how could a book have this many pages and be about banking in Oklahoma before statehood? What made you narrow on that topic?
Well, I appreciate being here, and I can explain that. My problem really was figuring out what I could leave on the editing room floor because I found such rich repositories of documents, photographs even, newspaper correspondence, articles, editorials, you name it. There's a lot of material to go in here. So it could have been a whole lot longer if I hadn't got out my scalpel.
When you look at that period of banking history, where did you start? Where did you find that you had to start in order to make sense of how the banking system in Oklahoma came about?
Well, this is going to seem a little odd maybe to Oklahoma readers, but I actually started with the Battle of Yorktown in Virginia in 1781. And as your listeners well know, that was way before this place was even a thought. But what I needed to do as I got into the literature on Oklahoma is I realized that so many of the experiments, so many of the financial models, so many of the banking policies, merchant banking, commodity money, all these things that I explained, all of them had precedents in the East. And so the point was I needed to spend a couple of chapters trying to distill that post-Revolutionary War period up through the Civil War into a nice, succinct little package so that when I bring these things up in later chapters, pertaining to Oklahoma, they would make sense. They'd make sense in the context of American history.
And, of course, Oklahoma being really fairly late on the scene in terms of states and because of its unique history and being divided, just before statehood, how did that affect this story?
Well, the truth is, I don't even get to the statehood period until probably halfway through the book, because what I discovered is there's a lot of literature on, and this is primary sources, by the way. There's not a whole lot of secondary sources that I found, but I found a lot on the riverboat frontier, beginning with French traders in the late 18th century, really. The Choteaus, I mean, they were doing big business in the Muskogee area, Fort Gibson area, long, long before non-Indian settlement came into this area. So I covered that, and then because the Santa Fe Trail crosses a little section of Cimarron County, that sort of opened up the whole Santa Fe Trail trade from Missouri to the Spanish settlements and what's now New Mexico. And then, once I kind of establish those chapters of Oklahoma commercial history, then there's the whole Indian trade and bartering. Long before there was anything like banks on the frontier, there was all kinds of frontier ingenuity at work, figuring out how to trade goods and establish values. So I've got some great material on trading, what Native American tribes would accept as units of value. I found a great little interview, and I don't know exactly when this took place, probably 1880s, 90 possibly. But there was a situation where a Native American rode up with a young woman. He wanted to trade for some head of cattle. And these things come to us as a little bit shocking, but trade was the order of the day, and it had the added effect of establishing really peace between non-Indians and their Native American neighbors.
And in terms of what banking brings to, I would call it a developing economy that Oklahoma was at that time, as you kind of talked about a few of those things that were going on, I know for me, when I think of banking and bankers and things like that, I don't necessarily understand the importance of those institutions in that early development of an economy. And you really, I think, highlight that and get into that in the book.
Yeah, and that really gets at the merchant banking section. There are a lot of retail establishments, and a lot of people have heard of them, the old Red Store in southwest Oklahoma, the Drummond Store up in the Osage Country. There are lots of very well-known, basically retail establishments. A lot of those retail establishments did business with the Native American tribes. They did business with cattlemen who were grazing their herds in the area. And there had to be some way of buying and selling merchandise. And so really what these merchant bankers did was they began to accept deposits from some of their customers, and they might deposit some, you know, bag of gold or something of clear value, and they would use that as a credit mechanism to get their flour and coffee and bacon and beans, whatever they need to take back to the ranch. And eventually those retailers would use that hard currency to restock their shelves from primarily Eastern wholesalers, you know, maybe somebody in Kansas City or Dallas or Chicago or something like that. And then they would bring the goods back in. So they really were de facto bankers. And that's where a lot of our early banks came from. And these guys, you know, after a few years doing this, they said, you know what? We got a bank here. We might as well put a sign on the front door and call it that. So it was a very ad hoc situation. And some of it, in order to establish capital, when actual banks did come into play and you did have to have some kind of capital on hand to loan out money, literally they'd throw an IOU in a coffee can and say, well, we got $100 because I got $100 IOU in that coffee can. And that's the way a lot of banks were established. It's the stories, to go back to what I said earlier, I hated leaving some of them on the cutting room floor, but I just had to.
Well, tell me one of those stories that really sticks with you out of the many from that time period.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Let me take a stab at one of them. There was a store in Muskogee Indian Territory. It's called Patterson Mercantile Company. And Patterson Mercantile Company started, as many other, you know, a lot of these retail establishments did, and by bartering with their customers. And this store just became so successful that they found that they had thousands of dollars stored behind the counter in an old booth. I don't know where they put it. But they had all this currency stored up. And so they said, well, I think we're a bank. But they never actually put the word bank on their money bags and on their different signage because there wasn't any sense of it. They didn't want to waste ink. Everybody knew it was a bank, so why fool with it? So this became one of the go-to places in eastern Oklahoma for shoppers. And I found an account of a young woman named Ella who actually worked there. I mean, she was like sales clerk. She was like, you know, you go into any store today, and there you got your sales clerk. That was Ella. She was trying to make it in the retail business, and it was a tough business, on her feet all day, probably wearing corsets and couldn't hardly stand up at the end of the day. But she made it. She became particularly adept at working with black customers, and there was, of course, eastern Oklahoma, a lot of black settlers in that area. But she describes mob scenes when things would go on sale. I mean, it's like a blue light special. And she describes the china they were selling, the linen, the customers who'd come into town in their wagons and maybe spend a couple of nights in town because they might have come 50 or 75 miles to go shopping. And she has just a great description of the frenzy of activity in this retail establishment that was acting as a bank because even in its early days, there still wasn't a bank in town, but they managed to make their barter system and their de facto banking system really work. And the part that I really enjoyed about that is she described going to Patterson Mercantile as that was the go-to place. If you need to talk to somebody, if you needed to meet somebody, that's where you went. And it sort of the image that came to my mind was the Agora of ancient Athens, where everybody showed up to trade, talk, philosophize, punch Socrates out, whatever they happened to want to do. And it was really that cultural center of Muskogee, and it all came from trade and eventually turned into a bona fide bank.
You have some stories, too. You mentioned the word frenzied activity, and some of these banks, their stability was not entirely, it just wasn't there in some cases. And I think those stories I found very interesting because, of course, today, when we've had our own banking issues in this country, you know, in the last 5 years, 10 years, but nothing like some of the scenes you have.
Well, in fact, some of those banks weren't even there. One thing that comes across in the correspondence, and I have a lot of the original telegrams, handwritten notes, you know, things typed out on early typewriters from the turn of the 20th century, correspondence between the territorial secretary and Guthrie and either bankers or guys who couldn't wait to get in the business. But what you find is that a lot of those banks literally weren't even there. I mean, I have stories of one in particular of a bank examiner going over to the Tahlequah area, and he gets off the train. He's looking around for a bank, doesn't see anything, sees some old guy riding a mule, and he asks him where the First National Bank is. And a guy on a mule looks at him and he says, "Stranger, I've been here 30 years, and I don't know what you're talking about. Do you want a sand bank or a clay bank?" And the bank examiner, Filson, by the way, Charles Filson, who went on to become an important state official, knew not to press it. He just got back on the train and got out of Dodge because he knew perfectly well that just because a bank was supposed to be somewhere didn't mean that it really was there. And the analogy to that is, when these early towns were founded, the boosters would build these little towns up to be the next New York City. And they would lure, you know, settlers and urban or rural settlers into these areas. And they'd get off the train looking for the next El Dorado, right, where they're going to make the big money. And all they'd see was a ramshackle building and a few tents and a couple of gamblers hanging out in the street. So testimonials of boosters was not always the best way to know where a town was, any more than some sort of vague promises of a bank meant that it was actually there.
And it was interesting to read also that you talked about the merchants and the retailers and their role in developing these early banks. And they also served to even bail out some of the banks that would actually get into trouble when we did have more of a bank.
Yes. Oh, there's all kinds of mergers. But one thing you need to understand is the banking codes were not actually written until 1897. Okay, so, you know, I describe all the pre-territorial period up through the land run of 1889 and then establishment of the Oklahoma Territory in 1890. Then you've got 7 years into the territorial period where the state was actually separated between the Oklahoma and Indian territories. You got 7 years in there where there's no banking codes. And we borrowed from other states, such as Nebraska. It was really an ad hoc system. And plus, you had a dual banking system. You could either get your charter, the all-important charter, which cost a grand total of $11 to get your territorial charter. And that includes a dollar filing fee. But you actually got that from the territorial secretary if you were operating what would eventually become a state bank. National banks were regulated by the Comptroller of the Currency in D.C. So if you wanted to establish a national bank and cast your lot with the nefarious Eastern money men, and you've got that whole dynamic, which really continues today, come to think of it. But, during those certainly first 7 or so years, there really weren't even any Oklahoma banking codes to go by.
We're talking with Michael Hightower, author of Banking in Oklahoma Before Statehood, a new book that really outlines the early days of not only the banking system that was created in Oklahoma before 1907, but also provides a primer on how the national banking system came to be. I saw several mentions of banks that I actually recognize today. Do we have any legacy banks still existing in Oklahoma that can tie directly to the period you're talking about in your book?
We do. And that actually was one of the motivations for this project. Most everybody listening today knows very well that Oklahoma is a relatively new state, right? Came into the Union in 1907. And because of that, we still have lots of banks in the state that are operated by third, fourth, or fifth generation members of the founding families. And one of the things that I've done for this book, and then I've got a sequel coming out next year on 20th century banking, but one of my research methods, and this kind of goes to my sociology background, and this is what has really been fun and really been just an honor, is I've gone all over the state and interviewed these descendants. The Pittman family and Sealing and Durant. I've been down there, talked to the Massey family. There's just lots and lots of banks in the state that have carried their foundation stories into the 21st century. Now, what's interesting is a lot of these stories, really contributions to the state's commercial history, a lot of them never made it too far out of the communities where they originated. And so you discover these little pockets of where somebody was a real legend in his time. And sometimes I've even come across unpublished memoirs, maybe tucked away in somebody's desk or filed, and, you know, I got to go scramble to find these things. But often there are, I can piece together enough, either documentary evidence or through interviews, however I can get it, and I can get these foundational stories. So, yeah, you can still go around Oklahoma today and see a number of these banks, and they will proudly tell you that they go back to the foundation of the territory itself.
Land was a pretty hot commodity in the territories around this time, too. What role did the buying and selling and exchange of land play in terms of the establishment of banking in Oklahoma?
Well, that was big. I mean, you know, if you're a farmer and, you know, you got to put in your crops, or you've got, you know, acquire additional land after the homesteading period was over, I mean, you had to go through some sort of an intermediary. And banks, wherever they are, I mean, universally, they do two things. They control credit and they control the flow of currency. And so any, whether you're talking about, and this is, you know, later in the statehood period, but whether you're spudding an oil well or you're expanding your cattle herd or whatever you might be doing, you needed to have some way to, or certainly buying land, you had to have some way to finance that activity. And so that's why banks are so crucial, and that's why they became such cornerstones of their communities. And one of the universals that I've found in interviewing bankers and asking them about the old foundation stories is I've probably conducted 60 interviews so far, and I got some to go for sure. And all of them focus on that community spirit, whether if they're talking about granddad or great-granddad before the Depression or something that happened last week. It's all about the control of currency and credit for the benefit of the communities. And that's one thing that has not changed, hadn't changed a bit.
In those early days, though, and it seems like I read a few stories about this in your book, that trust wasn't always there. I mean, that came, obviously, but, you know, early on, that trust was not easily earned.
Well, here's the deal. If you are in a little upstart town in the territory, and there's no banking establishments within maybe hundreds of miles, and you've got a little bit of money, you're accustomed to tucking that in your mattress or hiding it under a hay bale or whatever it is you do to safeguard your assets. One of the things the bankers had to do, and they had to work so hard to do, was to convince people who for generations had done exactly that, you know, squirrel away their hard-earned currency in the mattress. One thing they had to convince them to do was deposit it in their bank. And a way to do that was to build the most elaborate structure in town. And I think everybody listening is either lives in or driven through some small towns. You look on the corner, and what's there? I mean, invariably, it's a bank. And chances are they're really pretty, you know, whatever the style was of the day. We've all seen them. Some of us work in them. A lot of them are vacant, unfortunately. But, you know, a lot of them are still going concerns. But the point is, the bankers knew that to establish trust, to get those pioneers to let go of that hard-earned currency and deposit it in the bank and then ride 50 miles home, being pretty sure it would be there when they needed it, they would have to convince those people that they're there to stay. So really the elaborate architecture, the, you know, all the fancy fixtures that they would import from exotic places like St. Louis and Chicago, all that served a purpose. It was to show these pioneers that they meant business and that they were there to stay and that ultimately that they could be trusted with other people's money.
You alluded to a mistrust of Eastern financiers a little bit ago. In fact, those were your exact words. Where did that mistrust come from, and then how did we overcome it, or have we?
Well, I think you could argue that we haven't altogether overcome that distrust of Eastern money, or Easterners in general. But I think the best way to answer that is to describe the red-hot competition that sometimes got a little too red-hot between the territorial bankers who took out, as I mentioned earlier, the charters from Guthrie, and others who took out their charters from the Comptroller of the Currency in Washington, D.C. Oklahoma is, to the marrow of its bones, it's really a populist state. Prairie populism was red-hot in this area in the late 19th and early 20th century. A lot of listeners might remember William Jennings Bryan, the great orator, the great commoner from Nebraska, who was one of the most popular guys ever at the turn of the century, 1890s and early 20th century in Oklahoma. That sort of populism appeared in Haskell's administration, Charles N. Haskell, who's the first governor immediately after statehood. So we're a very populist state, and part of populism in those days meant that we wanted local control of our own money. The free silver debate, if anybody remembers that, but it was, you know, unlimited, or well, not unlimited, but more coinage of silver to expand the supply of currency and to basically put more coins in people's pockets. Those were big issues back then. And those were issues that territorial and then state bankers were believed to take more seriously and to have their community interests in mind. National banks, by definition, were regulated by the Comptroller of the Currency in Washington, and rightly or wrongly, they were perceived as not having that same sort of community spirit and same sort of community orientation. I'm not sure that's altogether true, and that's a debate and a conflict that really was one of the main themes of that whole territorial period.
There were some national banking crises that affected Oklahoma in that time. I want you to, first of all, set up one of those, and I want to have you read a passage from your book about the Oklahoma response to that.
Oh, sure. Recurrently throughout the 19th century, and I do get into this in the first couple of chapters, which are what was going on a national level, but about every 20 years we had a crisis. And you can really look at a timeline and say, yep, you know, 1857, 1873, 1893, 1907. It's really rather remarkable that every 20 years we get in big time trouble. The one that plays most directly into this particular book was a panic of 1893. Now, that came along only 4 years after the establishment of the territory. By that time, there were some very well-established banks. One of them was First National Bank of Oklahoma City, which actually traces its lineage back to the day of the land run on April 22 of 1889. But that bank was affected, as were all others in the territory, by this restriction of currency and credit, and basically people couldn't pay their bills. And there was no kind of Federal Reserve system to come to the rescue. New York had its J.P. Morgan, but that's another story. But what T.M. Richardson Sr. was the president of the First National Bank of Oklahoma City at that time. And one of the great stories is that as the crowds gathered in the street and bank next door posted up a sign that we're closed till further notice, a real bona fide, honest-to-goodness bank panic was in the making. And so what T.M. Richardson does, and I've got the newspaper articles, and this is all sort of ripped from yesterday's headlines, but he stood out there in front of his bank, and he said to all of the assembled multitudes with no microphone, he said, if you can't get your money out of this bank, string me up to that telephone pole over there. And he pointed to a telephone pole. And then everybody looked behind him, and there were bank employees going in the back door with bulging sacks. Well, what do you think when somebody's going in the building with a sack bulging with money, right? So everybody said, well, you know what? Old TM says we can string him up to a telephone pole if he's lying, and there's a bunch of guys going in the back door with bags of money. We must be okay. The bank panic dissipated. People very shortly started putting their money back in the bank. What they didn't know is that those bags going in the back door were full of washers and just scrap metal. So it was a ruse, you know. And it's not the first time. It certainly won't be the last that somebody's kind of, you know, pulled a fast one. But what that did is it assured folks that their money was going to be safe. He did eventually pull some connections and bring in some currency. And the bank panic did dissipate. But that's one of those stories that really are just priceless and that really testify to the ingenuity and, well, let's just say the ingenuity of these early day bankers.
All right. I do want you to read. I've selected a passage here, and if you would just read that for me.
Be happy to. This is a chapter called Bust and Boom, and that is a chapter title that will be familiar to most people, I suspect. The media responded to the national financial crisis with typical frontier chutzpah. The territory of Oklahoma, since it was open to settlement a little over 4 years ago, has made remarkable progression, ran a story in the Oklahoma Daily Press Gazette just a couple of months after the panic had passed. Oklahoma is a country of young men, full of the ideas, energy, and courage that make countries great. Not surprisingly, in a region so recently hewn from the frontier, politicians were seen as serpents in the garden, whose wiles were the only impediment to unending prosperity. The territory is in a very prosperous condition, everything considered, but is handicapped by territorial government.
And one of the reasons I picked that chapter, and you've mentioned the populism in Oklahoma, but there has been this mistrust of government and of institutions that, you know, you don't have to read many headlines today to see that going on. What do you think are the main lessons from the past in terms of our financial industry in Oklahoma generally, you know, connecting that today? You said you're working on your sequel, so I'm kind of asking you to forecast a little bit about what that book's going to be like.
Well, I gave that a lot of thought. I mean, you go to all this trouble to do all this research, and it's just a great gift to be able to do it. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to draw some conclusions. You know, what was all the sound and fury about? What are the lessons we can learn? And without giving away too much, because I cover that in my epilogue, but I really did distill some themes from this sweep of history, beginning with French fur traders and winding up with, well, actually winding up with another panic, the Panic of 1907, which coincided with Oklahoma's statehood celebration on November 16th, 1907. But I did draw some themes, and some of them will strike everybody as pretty familiar. One theme is that Oklahoma has never been a stranger to bad publicity. I mean, bad PR has been with us for a long time, and it was actually an impediment to economic development. This may partially answer your question, but it's a pretty good story. But there were actually insurance companies that forbade their agents in the Oklahoma and Indian Territories to issue policies to anybody or any business within 25 miles of an Indian reservation. And I've got a great quote that was an invasion of Indians was about as likely as an invasion of Cossacks from Siberia. But these kind of things were common. Bad publicity, and I think a lot of the commercial patterns, a lot of the banking practices, a lot of the fears and the biases, all these things stemmed from a state that has always had a PR problem. In the territorial period, there was plenty of frontier mayhem, and I do cover this in the book, plenty of bank robberies, good old-fashioned bank robbers and fast horses and gunplay, plenty of that to interest readers back east, and they lapped it up. But there were also journalists back in the old days who embellished those stories. They didn't need it, but they embellished them anyway, to the point where the old outlaw Bill Doolin was reportedly gunned down about twice a week. And he could be 100 miles away from some town, but it's no problem to plan some bank robbery. And so you get these really fascinating examples of the bad PR that did impede economic development. I think that's one thing that's with us today. I've spent a lot of my life in the East, really, and some of the old, you know, biases and myths persist about the Wild West. It astonishes me to this day, but it was even more prevalent and had a tremendous impact on, as I say, economic development back then. I think also what comes out of this period is a real willingness to experiment. I mean, as I've said, we didn't even have banking codes till 1897. Well, what does that say? We had 7 years to experiment. And there were lots of folks who came into the Oklahoma and Indian Territories 19th century intellectuals. Alexis de Tocqueville, a lot of people be familiar with him. James Bryce, who's an intellectual law professor from Oxford. A lot of big hitters. Even the sociologist Max Weber in 1904 made a tour of the Indian Territory. But these people all were on the same page when they looked at Oklahoma's tendency for bold experimentation, sometimes kind of rash. They noticed that America was known everywhere as a country of businessmen. You know, the America of business is business. We have that repeated throughout our history. It was magnified in Oklahoma and the Indian Territories. Let's face it, people came here to make money. I mean, we have all the, you know, the mythology, which has basis in fact for sure, about the beautiful land and all these pioneers extolling the virtues of their new home and so forth. But let's face it, these were folks coming here to strike it rich, to begin their lives anew, and front and center was getting free land or cheap land and making something of it.
Michael Hightower, author of Banking in Oklahoma Before Statehood, thank you so much. And you're right, there are we didn't even touch many, many, many of the stories and themes in this book, and I wish you the best of luck.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure being here.